This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. My pleasure to be with you this evening. Going to be solo at least during the beginning this evening. We've got JB on the road but heading back to his house where he may join us later on. And we have Captain Kirk is also driving at the moment. He might also be able to chime in before we're done this evening. For those who listen particularly to the longer version of these programs, the one that is in the archives, whether it's on Blog Talk Radio that you listen or you listen via the Yahweh Bereth site, yahwehbereth.com, that JB manages, you probably are aware that over the last 2 weeks, I've been engaged in a project to correct and improve the terms volume of An Introduction to God. And the reason for that is that I have a member named Alan. Many of you may know him, some may not. But Alan has engaged in a project that has really made a tremendous difference. It's he's publishing all of the Yada Yada volumes from seven volumes of Yada Yada, the five of An Introduction to God, Questioning Paul, the books of Observations for Our Time, then two volumes on Amazon. And Amazon now has the ability to present beautiful color covers and these books on short run publishing, where you order it on a Tuesday and it'll show up on your doorstep on a Thursday. And they're surprisingly inexpensive. So he wanted to create, in addition to the books that have already been published, he wanted to take the terms, which is the analysis of presentation of the 10 statements that Yah etched in stone, and he thought that would be a really effective introduction to what we have learned about Yahweh and his testimony in the covenant. So he was just going to publish it and had a beautiful cover for it, and that's what we're going to do until I realized, it had been 10 years since I had last translated, even looked at that. And oh my goodness, how much we have learned in the intervening time, that I decided that the better approach would be to retranslate all of the statements and then to rewrite all of the insights and just make certain that it was up to snuff with what we've come to know. And I don't know if it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Sometimes I think, I'm making really good progress. Other times I think I'm slower than molasses on a cold winter day. But that's how long it took to get the rewrite done. And it it's, you know, it was more than just a rewrite. It's the new one's, I think, 88 pages, and the first variation of it was 40 pages. So, you know, it's like more than double from what it previously was. And you may wonder, well, okay, why is he taking all the time to do this? Because I've now since moved on, and I'm well into Chapter 3 of Volume 3 of Observations for a Time, beginning on the 6th Mizmor, which is interesting all in and of itself. Well, there's something that happened along the way, and last week, you may recall that we had made it to the speech that Solomon gave, a prophetic statement that Solomon gave about during the dedication of the temple, with all Israel gathered around him. And he's, you know, he begins by declaring all the wonderful promises that Yahweh had made to Dod, his father, which I think is the single most important person in human history. And then he talks about the very essence of the house that is behind him, you know, gleaming. It's just been constructed and, you know, exactly as Yahweh had asked. And it's, you know, it holds the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone. And it holds the original autograph of the Torah, as well as the Ark of the Covenant, are all in the rightful place inside of it. And as he finishes disclosing all that and telling all those gathered of Israel all of the wonderful things that will happen to them if they simply love Yahweh, choose to observe his Torah guidance and respond appropriately, he recognizes, or he's prophetically been told, that that is not what's going to happen. That Israel is going to go astray, and it's not just for a short period of time, and it wouldn't be take a long time for that to happen. It was Solomon himself who led them astray. Solomon began wonderfully, but by the time that Solomon had incorporated foreign wives into his harem and had acquiesced to their indulgences of honoring false gods, Israel was well on the way to the diaspora and conquest, and it fell apart. And so that was imminent on the horizon, and it has been, really, since that time, fully 3,000 years ago, that Israel was a united whole, paying attention to, focused on, in love with Yahweh and his Torah testimony and part of his covenant. And so one of the things that I learned as I was, after I had translated this presentation, where, well, we're going to go over those words again, where Solomon says, you know, because of the fact that you're going to go astray, Yahweh has provided this Nakri for you. And the comments he makes about the Nakri. I'm going to actually read those comments today, not from the chapter that we were in, which was Chapter 2 of Volume 3, but from the Terms and Conditions volume of An Introduction to God. And the reason for that is for something that I was unprepared for. I don't know if you all know, but I've certainly come to know here just in the last couple of weeks that there isn't one but two presentations of the Ten Statements in the Torah. And they are remarkably different, particularly in the two areas that are subject to misunderstanding. One of those, and we'll discuss with this in a moment, one of those is the presentation on valuing your mother and father, viewing them as extraordinarily significant, glorious. And the difference is that in the one that Moshe speaks about in Shemot 20, Exodus 20, it's just very matter of fact. It's kabod. View is extremely important and relevant, and and substantial, and your mother and father, so that your days in the land will be extended. Well, that's not the case with the presentation of that statement in the body. And we really have two choices regarding the difference between these two. They're not contradictions at all, so there's not a contradiction at stake. But since the Dabaim presentation is so much longer and more complete than was the Shemot Exodus presentation, I think we have two ways of looking at it. One is, remember the two sets of tablets, the first set and the second set. And the second set could have had these two amplifications, not only on this, but that the next one is on the Shabbat. That's a possibility. The Dabaim presentation is not in Moshe's voice, it's in Yahweh's. So he's saying, this is what Yahweh told us. And it's an amplification of it. So it could well be that as Yahweh is going over the 10 statements, he says, I really want you to understand what I was writing about your mother and father and honoring them and seeing them as significant, and I really want you to understand the Shabbat. And so on those two, there's a lot more said. On honoring your mother and father, it was constantly telling us that it's that which is associated with. I'm making a comparison here such that you might understand. So the account of your mother and father is to be viewed as a metaphor. So that certainly is reassuring, particularly for someone who has gone so far out of their way to say, this is not about your earthly mom and dad, not at all. So that part I read with great pleasure. But I must tell you that the expansion on the Shabbat was both reassuring and also a bit concerning. And let me share this with you. I said there's an interesting connection between Yahweh's explanation of the Shabbat in the Dabarim words, Deuteronomy 5:15. Now, so by way of background, the first time I presented the terms, a volume of an introduction to God, I only translated the terms, the 10 statements, as they were presented in Shemot. This time I translated them in Shemot and in the body. And the reason that I did that is because I was convinced that Yahweh didn't write instead Nassau, relative to the statement on his name. I just didn't have any proof of that in an extant scroll, because Shemoth 20 is not extant in the Dead Sea collection. But the Dabarim 5, where the 10 statements are repeated, it is. So now I had a 2,000-year-old manuscript that I could study and make the translation based on it as opposed to the Masoretic text. And that's what drew me to it. What kept me there was the difference between the two. Not contradictory differences, but amplifications. They're kind of the way that we deal with Yah's testimony throughout all of these books. It's amplified. So, as I was reading, after having done the translation of Dabarim Deuteronomy 5:15, I saw a connection between the words that were added to it and Solomon's Sermon on the Mount during the dedication of Yahweh's temple, as presented in Dabarim HaYomim, words of the days, 2 Chronicles 6:32, which I thought was relevant. Now, as I've tried to explain, there seems to be a foreshadowing of something profoundly important to those of us living today. And that's why I'm going to share this with you. God appears to be announcing and orchestrating a second Exodus. Now I'm pausing there because I want that to sink in. I think that the way that God is presenting not only the Nakri statement and the Barim HaYomim, 2 Chronicles 6:32, but the way that he uses this, that the way that Solomon cited directly from this amplification of the Exodus as it was used to explain the Shabbat in Devarim 5:15. The same sequence of four words are used. And I think the conclusion is, and I could be wrong, but I want you to consider it nonetheless, that God appears to be announcing and orchestrating a second Exodus. One of the reasons that I was drawn to that conclusion beyond these four words is that we've come to know that God is not braggadocious. And while the story of the Exodus is profound and it's important and there's so many insights that can be drawn for it, why did God begin the 10 statements that he etched in stone, reminding those who were gathered around, who all participated in the Exodus? Oh, by the way, my name is Yahweh. I'm the one who led you out of slavery in Mitzrayim, in the crucibles of human oppression. Okay. They were all there. They were all eyewitnesses. They were all participants. They heard God explain this to them in his own voice from the fire on top of Mount Horeb, not once but twice. So you think he's telling them, oh, by the way, you know, I'm the same God who just did that? No, it wasn't for them. God's not bragging about defeating Egypt. It's prophetic. It's a dress rehearsal. He's telling us that he's going to do it again. And that we ought to be paying attention because today, his children, Israel and Yehudah, need to come out of Babel, of Babylon. Come out of her, my people. It's repeated in Jeremiah. It's repeated in Revelation. It's repeated throughout the story of the Torah and prophets. As a matter of fact, that's the exact account that's in Bereshit when Yahweh is telling Abraham to walk away from your country. He just said, my country, the country of Abraham was Babylon. It's the reoccurring story. And now, these very few years away now from Yahweh's return, he needs his people to walk away from Babylon. If they do not walk away from Babylon, he cannot reestablish his covenant relationship with them. It's a requirement for the covenant. And so what he is doing by injecting the story of the Exodus into the explanation of the Shabbat, and remember, the seventh millennia, this celebration of Sukkah that begins on Sukkah is really a 7,000-year Shabbat. It's the seventh day. And so in the presentation of the seventh day, he is interjecting the story of the Exodus because it is prophetic. There is going to be a second one just prior to the long celebration of the Shabbat. And then Solomon quoted this interjection of this juxtaposition of the Shabbat and Exodus to make a connection between the Nakri that he was speaking of in the second Exodus. That was my conclusion. You can make your own. Now this confession, as I wrote this, the 83rd page of the terms, new terms volume, I said I'm sharing these thoughts with you a decade after I originally translated and inscribed the fifth volume of An Introduction to God. And we've learned so much from that time to this that I wanted to improve, indeed correct, but mostly augment what I had written some time ago. In the intervening period, I had finished An Introduction to God, rewritten yada yada times. That's learned something new that was profoundly important. I want to make the corrections. And I completed two editions of Questioning Paul. And I'd also compiled the first two volumes of Observations for Our Time. And it started on volume 3 when I returned to correct and enhance terms. And it was there in the second chapter of the third volume of Observations for Our Time, entitled, How Will You Respond? That a citation from Dode's fifth Mizmor led me to his 20th Psalm, which took us to something directly related and profoundly important in Yeshayah 40. In the midst of that translation, one that fundamentally changes our focus from Yahusha, the Christian Jesus, toward Dode, David, we find ourselves grappling to find an appropriate definition for Zeruah, the same word Yahweh used to explain the purpose of the Shabbat. I'll bet you didn't know, I didn't know, that Zeruah is used to explain the purpose of the Shabbat. But it is. In search of the truth, I went old school, and I considered how Yahweh defined Zeruah through context each time he used it. And in so doing, I not only discovered an intriguing range of meanings, but also stumbled upon a statement, the affirmation dedication speech Solomon gave at the before the newly erected temple Yahweh's home, that rocked my world and may change your perspective on what you're reading. The words we're about to consider, as you know, were spoken by Shlomo, Reconciliation Solomon, Dode's son, upon the completion and commemoration of Yahweh's family home. At the seminal moment in the life of a united Israel, standing atop Mount Moriah, with the recently completed temple gleaming in the background, the man noted for his wisdom, Solomon, delivered the original Sermon on the Mount. He was dedicating the building Yahweh had designed to showcase the Ark of the Covenant, these very tablets of stone, and the original autograph of the Torah that Moshe had scribed, and which we have been studying. Yahweh had made, he said that with all Jacob's descendants gathered before him, and speaking of the promise Yahweh had made to his father Dode, while desirous of guiding his people's footsteps, Solomon used an especially descriptive term, Nakri, which speaks of a discerning foreigner from a distant place and time, speaking a different language, who, as a result of being observant, would come to understand. To tell the children of Israel how they should respond to the words this individual write on their behalf. The timing strongly suggests that they will become especially relevant during a second Exodus. After describing the importance of the Ark of the Covenant, which had been placed in the center of God's home, Solomon reiterated many of the wonderful things which would benefit Israel if the people continued to love Yahweh, sing his father's songs, and observe the Torah's guidance. But knowing that they wouldn't, realizing that their descendants would require an exodus of their own, Solomon wrote the following, including four especially revealing words. And I'm going to highlight those words as we go through them. Therefore, regarding someone else, an observant and discerning foreigner from a different ethnicity and geographic location, who will come to understand the Nakri. Someone from a different place and culture, speaking a different language, who, having paid attention, will comprehend. From Nakar, someone who, by being attentive and astute, will come to be acquainted, recognize, and acknowledge something which deserves our highest regard and respect. Who, to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, Asher, is not of your people, not of this Israel. He will come from a distant country in a distant time. Men Eretz Rakok. Out of a land a great distance from Israel and following a long interval of time. for the express purpose of being a witness and providing answers regarding your surprisingly important name. The influence of your hand, Yod. Yod is one of those four words that are used now in succession. The influence of your hand, your ability to accomplish the mission, especially your Yod, the first letter in your name, which is an open hand reaching down and out, and defines your role in our lives, denoting your ability to engage and accomplish the task at hand. Along with the powerful and passionate ruler who was prepared to lead. Remember, Yah was returning with Dod, and he is the Chazak, the very strong and influential individual with a fighting spirit who is ready and able to protect his people from those who would otherwise seek to harm them. And the protective and productive ram who shepherds the flock, the Zeruah. Remember, there are three of them, Moshe, Dod, and Yosha. The prevailing and effective nature, the strength, resolve, and overall ability of this remarkably important and impactful individual of action, who, as a leader and a fighter, is engaged as a shepherd among his sheep, who is fruitful in his ways, accomplishing the mission, especially when sowing the seeds of truth, while denoting and advancing the purpose of the arm of God, of his shepherd and sacrificial lamb. And you have extended Nata. This is whom you have extended and through whom you are stretched and reached out. Four words. Yod, Chazak, Zeruah, Nata. I'm going to finish Solomon's quotation. We're going to find these four words in the same order in the elongated presentation of the Shabbat in conjunction with the Exodus. This goes on, the prophecy that Solomon spoke goes on to say, when he arrives on the scene and chooses to pursue this, well, when he, speaking of the Nakri, comes, bringing and bearing these associations, wanting to clarify the proper direction toward the ultimate goal, which is to enter back into the relationship and to be included within the family, then he will help interested parties reconcile their relationship by providing those who exercise good judgment with the information and justifications needed to make a correct and reasoned decision regarding this familial relationship, the family. When you hear this out of the heavens coming from the atmosphere within the location where you live, then engage and act accordingly, doing everything which to show the way the observant foreigner, the Nakri, from a different ethnicity and geographic location who understands, has invited you to read. Kara El Ata. For the express purpose of being a witness who provides answers such that all peoples of the earth will have a genuine and ongoing opportunity to become familiar with, to know, to acknowledge, to accept, and to understand. Yada will be shown by Yada so that they might appreciate and comprehend your name, coming to respect and revere you simultaneously along with your people, Israel. And also so that they may know that truthfully, your family and this house, which is to reveal the correct path to walk, to give life meaning, that I have built for the family, is for those who are designated and called out by your name. That's the Barim HaYomim, words of the day, 2 Chronicles 6:33. So now, with Solomon's speech still reverberating in my mind, it became immediately obvious that his Sermon on the Mount drew inspiration from Yahweh's presentation of the Shabbat of the Exodus for a reason. These four words appear one after the other in both statements, Shazak, Yad, Zeruah, and Natah. I don't think it was by accident. Here now is the presentation that explains the purpose of the Shabbat by equating it to the Exodus. So, you should remember, Zakar, call to mind, recollect, mention, proclaim, that indeed you were a slave in the land of the crucibles of Egypt, the crucibles of religious and governmental oppression and military and economic subjugation. And Yahweh, your God, brought you out from there with a mighty and firm, powerful and productive Shazak, a very strong and influential, extraordinarily capable and intensely prepared hand, Yad. And with the sacrificial lamb and productive arm shepherding the flock, Zeruah, which will be extended, Natah. Shazak, Yad, Zeruah, Natah, all to explain the purpose of the Shabbat. He would go, this is now Yahweh's voice. He says, for this reason, Yahweh your God instructed you to approach by observing that which is associated with the day of the Shabbat, such that it is set apart and special. Well, what that means is that the Shabbat isn't a day to be idle and do nothing. It's a day to be on the move, to be going where Yahweh wants us to go, to be leaving the world of Babel, to be leaving the institutions of human subjugation, religious and governmental, military and economic, such that we are moving with Him home. He's now explained the real purpose of the Shabbat. So as I write this to you in the summer of, and I'm sharing this with you audibly on this program, in the summer of 2019, the ultimate celebration of Shabbat commences on Kippurim, reconciliations in the Yobel year of the Lamb of God in 6000 Yah, sunset, October 2nd, 2033. It's just 14 years away, some of which will transpire during the time of Yaakov's troubles. For Yahweh to fulfill His promise, to reconcile His relationship with His people, there must be another Exodus. There must be another Exodus. This one away from the crucibles of political, religious, and geographic Babylon. Political Babylon is the United States of America. Religious Babylon, the Roman Catholic Church. And geographic Babylon is now the lands that are infected by Islam. There is precious little time left to bring Yisrael and Yehuda back home, back to the promised land. Sadly, there doesn't appear to have been a single willing Yehud through whom Yahweh could convey this message, which means that there would be no prophet or shepherd for His people at this time, because only Yehud serve as Israel and God's shepherds and prophets. So there won't be one this time, as was the case with Moshe and Dod. But there would, nonetheless, be a witness, a Nakri, who would write what those seeking to be with Yahweh would need to para, read, and yada know. He would translate Yahweh's testimony and that of Moshe and Dod, of the actual Hebrew prophets and shepherds, into English, the language spoken by more people today, including Jews, than any other. There doesn't appear to be another candidate for this role in our presence or on the horizon, and since there isn't time for one to emerge and compile the requisite translations and insights, as I shared at the conclusion of this term's volume, you may want to ponder why Yahweh made this prophetic announcement regarding the Nakre, and then consider why Solomon included part of the Debarim presentation on the Shabbat and Exodus in his prophetic declaration. if they are addressing this time in these translations, then you're in the right place. And if not, reading more of what Yahweh had to say so that you can respond appropriately is always a good idea. So this is what we, the way that the terms volume of an introduction to God now concludes. As I wrote about the Nacre Declaration in the second chapter of Volume 2 of Observations for Our, actually second chapter of Volume 3 of Observations for Our Time, it was astonishingly sobering for me. I personally haven't gotten over it because it's, there's no wiggle room away from it. And, you know, there may be this conception that by me accepting the statement as applying to the books and the translations that I have written over these 19 years, 19 books in 19 years, and some 10,000 radio programs, it isn't something I do lightly because it isn't in my interest. To accept this reality, I bring on all manner of criticism upon myself. It isn't fun. It's biting. It's stinging. And so you might wonder, well, why would I even acknowledge it? And truthfully, if I had stumbled upon Solomon's speech 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I wouldn't even know how to process it. Would have made no influence on me whatsoever. Read right through it. In fact, if I had come upon Isaiah 40 and tried to translate it 5 to 10 years ago, I'd have been lost, because at that time I was still fixated on Yosha being the most important person who ever lived. And that prophecy, in properly translated and in context, cannot apply to Yosha, even though it's among the top two or three ever attributed to him. It would have spent my head reeling. And so sometimes all good things in their proper time. But now that we have come upon this, and the way that we came upon it, and the timing that we have come upon it, after 19 years worth of devotion to this task, of specifically reaching out to Yahweh's children, Israel and Yehuda, to call them back home, I can't find a way to rationally walk away from this connection. And since God made the prophecy, to ignore it would discredit the entire purpose of what we stand for. To ignore it would be, for the first time, to refuse to go where the words lead. It's more responsible than I want. It's more sobering than I know how to properly deal with. And it's very, very uncomfortable. But here's the reality. As we've learned so many times in Yashaya, Yahweh looked for someone with whom he could communicate over the vast chasms of time and found no one. Here, Yashaya acknowledges that when he was up in heaven and Yahweh threw open the doors to his home, there wasn't a single person outside those doors looking to come in. There was no one with whom Yah could work. No one qualified. And, you know, Yah likes qualified people. Moshe was qualified to do the job that he was asked to do. He was the only person on the planet who had walked away from Egypt and yet knew Egypt intimately, their politics, their religion, their military, their economic schemes. Which means that Yahweh didn't have to not only waste his time and Moshe's explaining all this so that Moshe could be effective, but more important, he didn't have to aggravate himself by going over all this rubbish with Moshe, because Moshe already knew it. He could focus on telling Moshe the good stuff. And so, as we've come to recognize that, to deny this would be a fool's folly. It'd be to reject where the words lead. I'm going to accept that this is what Yahweh asked his people to read. This is what he asked them to respond to. Not because I have anything to say, but because he had a lot to say. And we're the first to, in a very long time, to take his words seriously and to translate them methodically in an amplified and correct way from the oldest extant text into the lingua franca of the world, but particularly the language that not only most Jews speak, far more Jews speak English than Hebrew, but the language that the Jews of the diaspora, the ones that need to be called home, speak. So at the conclusion of the second chapter of volume 3, I wrote the following. I said, God isn't kidding around with any of this, nor should we. It's long past time that the world, especially Israel, listens to what Yahweh actually had to say. The ability for everyone the world over to listen to someone whose words and voice come out of the sky was not possible until very recently, coinciding with the time that we began nearly 20 years ago. Advancing technology, communication satellites, broadband internet, and 7 billion smartphones have made it possible for almost everyone to listen simultaneously, along with Israel. Other than Yahweh speaking directly to humanity in his own voice, which isn't possible in this context, because he is not an accurate foreigner. Imagine the wonderment in the mind of those listening to Solomon 3,000 years ago, trying to ascertain how this could even be possible. Since God is not the voice out of the sky, then how would everyone on earth be able to listen and benefit concurrently? And why, they may have wondered, would God want to speak through a foreigner to Israel and to Goyim concurrently, from outside Israel, in a language other than Hebrew? But that's what these words mean. The preamble to this prophecy is amazing, and yet now, since this capability is so integrated into our lives, with the average individual spending 7 hours a day listening, looking, and reading that which they have selected from the cloud, the fulfillment appears almost mundane. But still, consider the unlikely intersection of someone thousands of years and thousands of miles from Israel, a complete stranger in a different place and time, becoming so enthralled with Yahweh's words that he would compose 7,000 pages of insights on the Torah, Mikra, and Beret, all gleaned by translating Yahweh's word into the lingua franca of the world, the language spoken by more Yehudim than Hebrew, somehow stumbling upon the realization that Dod is the Son of God, that Yahweh's Mashiach and Malach are Dod, which is why he's the one returning. And then at the same time, what is the likelihood of him figuring out that Moshe, Dod, and Yosha are all Zerua, while producing 7,000 internet-based audio programs to share what he had learned so that Yisrael could engage with Yah by listening to him, explaining what Moshe and Dod had written and Yosha had done. As was the case with the Choder, insignificant branch composing the neck banner, this isn't because this Nakri, observant and discerning foreigner, is special, because he, like those whose words are vital, remains mostly anonymous. He is simply doing what Solomon did on this day, citing the promises Yahweh made to Moshe and Dod. 3,000 years ago, Yahweh revealed that he would use the Gentile to reach his people and to call them home. He would even endorse what he would write and say, telling his people to do as he said, recognizing that this Nakri would Nakar come to know him by being observant, that he would come to understand him by being discerning, and then base everything he would write and say on what he observed by closely examining and carefully considering the Torah and the Nabi, the guidance and prophets. He would even yada yah focus on the importance of knowing and understanding Yahweh's name. He would yada yah. Now we know why Yah wanted his message written in English. Why the proper recognition of Moshe, Dod, and Yosha was so important to Yah, as well as why Yahweh would have to turn to a lowly Nakri known as Yada to awaken the mighty Israel. This may be the one and only time that Yahweh asked his people to engage based upon everything a foreigner had to say. Yet it was said of this Nakri that he would serve as a witness, as someone who provides answers which can be read and recited on behalf of people the world over, especially Israel. Beyond the written translations and insights found in Yada Yah, an introduction to God, questioning Paul, and observations for our time. Beyond the reach of Yah's word being recited through Yada Yah radio, this program, and Shattering Myths, might this also be inferring that Yada might be invited to serve alongside Elia as the unnamed witness during the time of Jacob's troubles? That's from Malachi, Malachi 4:5, and Zechariah chapter 5. Don't know, it doesn't make much difference to us, I guess, at this time. Beyond all of this, there is one reason that the Nakri, observant and discerning foreigner, in a faraway place and time, would have been introduced and authenticated by Yahweh during the dedication of his home. Yahweh wants Israel and the world at large to consider what he has translated and shared, because the information, the insights, the perspective he is providing are relevant, credible, valid, reconciling, indeed dependable and trustworthy, because he has thoughtfully considered what he revealed through the likes of Moshe and Dod, Yeshaya and Yosha. By engaging something others, and engaging in something others were unwilling to do, the Nakri became so uniquely relevant to knowing Yahweh, to appreciating what he is offering, and to recognizing what he is asking in return, that God saw fit to validate his witness, one based entirely upon the Torah, Nabi, wa Mizmor. Well, I didn't write that then. Where else would you find Yahweh's name pronounced as he teaches us to pronounce it, as Yahweh? Where else do you find someone speaking of Zeruah and identifying the Zeruah? Where else do you find someone focusing on the Torah and pronouncing it as opposed to law? Where do you find someone conveying the fact that the centerpiece of the Torah is the Bereth covenant, and that there is but one of them, and that it has five conditions and five benefits? Where else do you find the covenant and Moed Mikre juxtaposed, so that one leads to the other, one facilitates the other? Where do you find the Mikre presented as feast to celebrate, each with a specific purpose in bringing Yah's children home? Where do you find Yah's plan of 6+1, of 6 1,000-year eras, marching through time from expulsion in the garden, or out of the garden, back home to Sukkah, camping out with God in the land. Where do you find all of that presented? Where do you find, in the midst of that presentation, a constant and reoccurring call for Yah's children, Yisrael and Yehuda, first and foremost, to come home and away from Babel? Now, to suggest that this has been yet another revealing sojourn into the Word, enabling us to make connections which lead to understanding, would be an understatement. And while we may want to linger here before we lose sight of the psalm, I want to return to it now, and we're going to continue and complete the fifth psalm, which brought us to the 20th, which brought us to Isaiah 40, which brought us to Solomon's statement, which brought us to the Nakri, and then in the translation of Tabanim 5, in the second presentation of the Shabbat in conjunction with the Exodus, discovered the fact that Solomon quoted Yahweh's Exodus explanation. These things are all connected. Well, let's continue. The fifth Mizmor, continuing his plea to be just, even fair, and thus hold those who have promoted political, religious, and conspiratorial schemes accountable for the misery that they have inflicted on Israel, and indeed on behalf of his people. This is what Dode wrote. And before I read the next statement in Psalm 5:9, I get more personal attacks for exposing and condemning conspiracies than everything else combined. Those that hold on to conspiracies and promote them are more zealous towards their conspiracies than any religious person that I've ever met. And to expose their conspiracies as utter foolishness, and they all are, is so enormously irritating to them that it's the number one cause of people to write me hate letters. The last three, the last five or six I've received, have all been based upon my exposure and condemnation of conspiracies. And what I want to share is that there's a reason that Yahweh asks us not to advance or uphold except conspiracies. And previously I had emphasized the fact that I did not want, and the one thing I said, you're free to use my translations, just do not use them in conjunction with any political agenda, religious agenda, or conspiratorial agenda. And the reason I didn't want them associated with a conspiratorial agenda is because you will discredit them. The conspiracies are so stupid that somebody who advances and upholds conspiracies ought not be trusted. And I don't want Yahweh's words, which need to be trusted and depended upon, mingled in with such nonsense, nor does he. But there's another reason. And that is that conspiracies, the number one conspiracy throughout time, has been that Jews are to blame for everyone's problems. Anti-Semitic conspiracies lie at the heart of really the whole genre. The protocols for the Elders of Zion wasn't the first. You know, it begins way back with Rome creating conspiracies to justify the obliteration of the province of Yehuda. You know, it begins even before that with what the Assyrians did and what the Babylonians did. And, of course, it was followed by Islam, with the Quran essentially creating the worst conspiracy of anti-Semitism ever foisted on humankind. And it's that same conspiracy of blaming the Jews that's responsible for the Holocaust. There is nothing God hates more than conspiracy, because most conspiracies and the most prevalent and enduring conspiracies have caused the death and separation of his children. So I want you to know that when it comes to exposing and condemning conspiracies, Yahweh is outspoken and he is blunt. And I will continue to be outspoken and blunt. If you choose to believe them, go away. Go bother somebody else. You aren't welcome here. So, continuing to plea, his plea, to be just, even fair, and thus hold those accountable who have promoted political, religious, and conspiratorial themes for the misery that they have inflicted on Israel and indeed people everywhere, Dode wrote. For, indeed, emphasizing this point, there is nothing that is firmly established or trustworthy in their mouths. There is nothing that is reliable, enduring, or steadfast among their words. Nothing secure or settled in their speech. Their inner nature is to be destructive with their malicious speech. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter, deceitfully seducing. I hear a little chirping of voices in the background, so that means, JB, you have now joined us. You've never been a conspiracy advocate. You weren't one of those that had to leave their company.
Well, when I was real young, teenager, you know, I kind of got into a little bit of that, but not real deep.
It's alluring. It's captivating. And, of course, what the conspiracy advocates find is fellowship. And, you know, the one common denominator, there's been countless research studies, because conspiracy is growing as rapidly as anti-Semitism now around the world, to the point where the majority of people the world over believe in all manner of just wild and crazy conspiracies. The most unifying of them, of course, is blame the Jews. And with all of that, there has been, of course, a number of academic studies on, you know, what prompts this, because one of the things they found is that liberals are just as likely to believe conspiracies as conservatives. They found that that the educated are just as likely to believe conspiracies as the uneducated. They have found that the religious are just as likely to believe in advanced conspiracies as are the secular. And so, in all of the research they found, and it's every study I've taken the time to read, there's a single common denominator among those who accept and promote conspiracies. You know what that is, JB?
They tend to be, well, for the lack of a better word, losers.
Oh, that's the word. In fact, that's even the word that's used in the research. They're losers. They're people whose lives are not fulfilling, who are looking for someone to blame other than themselves for their starry state. Either they're not making as much as they think they deserve, they're not living as nice a home as they think they ought to, their marriage isn't as fulfilling as they think that it should be. Whatever it is, they're unhappy with their lives and they don't want to take responsibility, so they want to blame someone else. And conspiracies are all a way of saying, well, it's the government that did it. It's the religion that did it. It's those damn Jews that are responsible for my sorry state. And what the conspiratorial find is the same thing the religious find. They only associate with their own kind. So I remember back in the day that we had a conspiratorial contributor that was part of this program, to my great embarrassment. And you know, when I would say, you know, he'd make some kind of a conspiracy like that the mass shootings in schools were all fake, that they were staged by the government. I mean, it's just asinine. It's so enormously hurtful, but that's what they would say. And I'd say, no, it isn't true. It's all, you know, I've done 15 hours of research on this. And they'd actually believe it. And what they've done is they go to websites where somebody has some video chat, video blog, rendering some nonsense about, you know, fake photos and Photoshop, and they believe it. This stunning percentage of people today believe that 9/11 was an inside job. The very government they want to condemn for manipulating them, they think was smart enough to pull off the 9/11 hoax and create false images of airplanes flying into buildings so that they can create some kind of a government scheme as opposed to just dealing with reality. And it's
and
so they just reinforce each other. Pardon?
Yeah, I've researched it. Spending 15 hours looking at conspiracy theory web pages telling you exactly what you want to hear is not research.
No. No. Going to an engineering site
is reading a web page.
Right. Going to a site that is written by scientists and engineers and says, this is the way architecturally those buildings were built. This is the way the support structures work. This is how much load they were designed to bear. And this is what happens with heat on steel and other forms of metal. And here's what happens when they are deformed through heat and weakened through heat, and now you have 2 and 3 times their designed weight. It's just read the scientific and engineering and architectural explanation.
They're able to get hundreds of people to lie about, you know, loading these planes full of gas that at the height they're dispersing would be so minute of a fact that they couldn't, you know, even be effective in the parts per million that they would reach the people. Or they're creating condensation because that's what happens when heat and cold and water mix.
But mind you, there's no biological agent that could survive the temperatures in a jet engine of about 900 degrees Celsius. But
yeah,
you're correct. That was the plot. That has to be the dumbest plot in all of creation because, A, it's visible and everybody can see it. And second of all, it's up there at 31,000 feet. You ever tried to breathe at between 31 and 39,000 feet?
Yeah.
And when they get down where the rest of us are, you don't see them anymore. Or the measles vaccine causing autism. When it was within just a matter of a year of the time that fraud promoted that, specifically because he was vested in a competitive vaccine. And he deliberately fabricated the research to create a fraudulent connection. And he was exposed in major periodicals within a year of the time that he made that claim. And that information has been out for everyone to read for 20 years. And that people still cling to it, to a lie that was not only proven to be untrue, but proven to be a direct monetary fraud. A man was disgraced, and England lost his medical license. That's why he moved to Texas. He's there with you, JB. He's in Texas. Of course he admitted to it. It was a deliberate fraud. And one after another.
You know, I got a sister-in-law who's married to a doctor, and I have another sister-in-law who thinks she knows more about how vaccines work than both of them combined. And she's never had a college degree, let alone a doctorate, but she's done the research because she looked at these articles online.
Yeah. Now, listen, there are, here's someone can make the argument, that there are vaccines which can cause harm. It's true. One out of every 130,000 people that are vaccinated with the MMR vaccine will have a significant and negative reaction to it. That's bad. And if we could figure out whose genetics was going to have a negative and bad reaction to it, by golly, we would do it. But you know how many hundreds of thousands of people are alive today that wouldn't be alive without that vaccine?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, well, it's like everything in life. There's always trade-offs. I could have walked today to lunch and maybe been safer. We took a boat to lunch. But, you know, it was a lot more fun going on the boat. So that takes some risk, sure. But, you know, come on, folks.
As the saying goes, anyway, the leading cause of death is living.
Yeah, so Doty says, "Say, listen, liars lie. That those that advance conspiracy, those that advance religion, those that, you know, I was here with some friends, and one of them said that I think it's her father is a very successful Christian pastor." And this particular individual was very well-schooled in Hebrew. That was his specialty. Did lots of translations. And, you know, he brought up to him, he said, you know, the set-apart spirit is imminent. He said, yeah, but it's irrelevant. You know that Yahweh's name was written 7,000 times and his testimony is replaced by the Lord. Yeah, but well, why is that important? He said, well, you know, I've come to read and study the and check upon and verify the translations that are written in Yada Yah and in Induction to God and in Observations for a Time. You're an expert in Hebrew. Why don't you look at them and see if you can invalidate them? You know what his comments were? I don't know. Their translations are accurate. I can't invalidate them. But in my opinion, they're too literal. They're too literal. Now, Jamie, you do a lot of translation.
Literally.
Yeah, when you do your translation, what is your number one goal?
To be as accurate as possible.
Which means to be as literal as possible with the words, right?
Yeah.
The reason that you and I can't just translate literally, which is what we do, which is the only way to translate, I'm tell you what, you're a smart dude. I may be smarter than the average mutt, but do you think that I'm going to present myself as being smarter than God and try to interpret what God's saying in his translation as opposed to provide as complete and accurate, therefore literal as translation as is possible? I'm going to do that. But the reason that we can't just translate and we feel compelled to add the commentary is in the commentary we can explain the symbolism behind it. We can explain the relevance of it. We can interpret it such that it is more revealing than just the literal words. But when it comes to the Word of God, we need to be literal.
I'm going as literal as possible, and this is what this is saying.
Yes. And then it was interesting, as she told me, this woman told me the same story. She said, I want you to read Questioning Paul. Which he picked up and began reading and gave it back to her and said, I can't read this. Dealing with what this reveals about Paul would be like me dealing with my wife cheating on me.
So let's just bury our head.
The word was untrue. It's just that he was so married to Paul that Paul being proven to be a false prophet, Paul cheating him, was like reading his wife was cheating on him. And therefore, he handed it back. Isn't that astonishing? Yeah. So, I'm here to tell you that the religious, nothing but rubbish, nothing trustworthy, established or true, comes out of their mouths. And, you know, keep in mind that just because somebody includes some truth mixed in with what they say, that doesn't make them more accurate, more credible. It makes them less credible because it makes their lives more believable. You know, it's like somebody trying to pass a counterfeit bill by making it look as close to the real one as possible versus someone that's going to paint one and polka dots with the ducks floating on it. You know, if you're completely having no truth strands through it, no true strokes, no one's going to believe it. So they tried to make some of it accurate. But I don't care how close to being accurate a counterfeit bill is. It's a liability, not an asset.
Worthless.
What's worse than worthless? It'll get you in serious trouble.
Yeah.
For there is nothing that is firmly established or trustworthy in their mouths. Their inner nature is to be destructive with their malicious speech. And I love this line. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter, deceitfully seducing. Boy, Dode has them nailed. You know, he's talking about whom? I mean, he's not talking about his neighbor. You know, he's not talking about the dude down the street. For him to make these kind of sweeping statements, he's talking about the religious influences, the political influences. That's what he's talking about. There's nothing firmly established or trustworthy in their mouths. Their inner nature is to be destructive and to be malicious with their speech. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter, deceitfully seducing. You know, Dode is right, once again. Nothing redeeming comes out of the mouths of the political or religious. They are, as he established, rotten to the core. Their every word is malicious and counterproductive. They are all relentless liars. When they're soaring in majestic buildings paid for by others, and within these and with the mystique of authority and trappings of power, their deceitful words are seductive, but they're also deadly. They have made themselves so hard to ignore, so prominent and integrated within the society, that they've become difficult to oppose. There is no media outlet or mass communication venue willing to risk the backlash from believers who can't even fathom the possibility that those that they admire are playing them for fools. Fortunately, Dode has God's ear, and from his lips to Yah's heart, this is what will occur. He says, hold them accountable, God. They have fallen of their own accord through their advice and schemes. Cast them out along with the great abundance and widespread nature of their revolting rebellion, because indeed they have been contentious in their defiance against you and have bitterly rebelled against you. This is being spoken to the religious, to the political, to the conspiratorial. Hold them accountable, God. They have fallen of their own accord through their advice and through their schemes. Cast them out along with the great abundance and widespread nature of their revolting rebellion, because indeed they have been contentious in their defiance against you. What Yahweh says, don't advance conspiracies. I mean, the entire book of Yeshayah, up to the point that we moved on to other things, was a treatise on God's animosity towards religion. You know, when you read what Yahweh had to say about politics, when the people wanted to choose Shaul, King Shaul, okay? To go ahead and be political is an overt defiance of him. God, don't say, kick them out. They have been contentious. Do away with them. Very early on in this process, nearly 18 years ago, we came to realize that by sending the religious to Sheol, God was being fair. They dug their own graves. They have all fallen of their own accord and stumbled on their own words. Each and every one has tripped on their tongues. Their advice and counsel, their customs and traditions, their proposals and practices, and especially their conspiracies and their religions, have cost the unsuspecting their souls and have taken countless others to where they themselves are headed. And it's not just that they're provocateurs, but also their provocations, their religious and their religions that must be banished for heaven to exist on earth. It's not just the obliteration of religion, but of the religious that is necessary for heaven to exist on earth, for us to return to the conditions found in the Garden of Eden. You know, it's the greatest irony of all. Claiming to speak for God, claiming to serve God, claiming to provide access to God, religious leaders are universally in rebellion against Yahweh. Bitterly contentious and openly defiant, such that everyone, without exception, who believes them dies estranged from God. This is not a victimless crime. All religions lead away from Yahweh, as do all who advocate on their behalf. And yet, even when God himself reveals that he is universally opposed to the religious and will cast them away for the great abundance and widespread nature of their rebellion, the religious are not only incapable of processing God's testimony, they angrily attack Yah's word and those who share it with them. There's a better way. So, let all who take refuge in you, let everyone who places their trust in you, relying upon you to keep them safe, rejoice and be glad. Let them choose to sing uplifting and joyful songs. Cover and clothe them, such that those who love your name will rejoice in having chosen you. Another friend of mine was talking about the fact that she didn't think of herself as an effective communicator of Yahweh's testimony. And yet, the preponderance of those who are part of her family and extended family know and love Yah. Sometimes over the course of three generations. And so you'd have to say, well, why? Because this person was once a Christian. They stumble upon what we're talking about here in the same place that Kirk and Terry did, which was the last program I did on a show with a guy who was open to criticizing Islam, but didn't have much like the notion of criticizing Paul. And just one day, I stumbled and listened to the show, and it was her countenance, her attitude, her approach to learning the truth that was infectious. She was singing an uplifting and joyful song. She was covering and clothing herself such that her love for Yahweh's name and her willingness to rejoice at what she had found and this comfort that comes on trust and relying upon the creator of the universe was infectious. More than anything, that's what caused those who were near and dear to her to accept the truth. It is perhaps the single most amazing realization in the universe. God allows us to choose him. Isn't that amazing? You'd think if you created the universe and conceived life and then created family, that if you did all of that, that you'd at least choose who you'd want to be part of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But God allows us to choose him.
Better if they choose.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? He allows us to choose him. Yeah, I think it is it's amazing and wonderful, all wrapped up in one marvelous expression of free will. The truth be known, there is nothing more enjoyable or rewarding than developing a personal relationship with our Heavenly Father. We give up nothing of value and gain everything worthwhile when we choose to trust and rely upon Yah. And the first step in the process after making acquaintances is, as Dode has written, coming to appreciate to the point of falling in love with God's name, Yahweh. So why is it that there isn't a single religious denomination or political party named after Yahweh? Why is it that the religious have actually changed and replaced Yahweh's name, removing it from his testimony 7,000 times, replacing it with Satan's title, and then calling the resulting book Babel, Bible, with the Lord? Why is it that as few as one in a million actually know and say Yahweh?
you know, religious the, don't want you to know God's name, because a God that would want to know you on a name-to-name, you know, personal level wouldn't have their church hierarchy that gives them their power.
Correct.
Now, the God who is a Lord, lording over us, he'd have a hierarchy of those under him.
Yeah. I was corresponding just moments before this show with Alan, the person that is taking the text of these books and making them such that Amazon can print them. And he was had just finished his edit review of the Terms volume that he's going to publish as a standalone book. And he said, you know, as I went through the third statement, it talks about God's not forgiving those who negate the value of his name. He said, you know, for you, Asher, was your aha moment when you saw that the prophecies in Shamuel the Masiyah, by the work of Yah, not the Masiyah, but the Masiyah, the work of Yah Yosha, that, you know, when he sins, I will not spare the rod. And what it really says is when sin is associated with him, I will not spare the punishment. That Asher was the word that said, well, if every translation got this wrong, then what else did they have wrong? And that's why I started translating. For him, it was him. And this statement, the fact that God has a name, that he wrote his name 7,000 times, and that religious men had the audacity to remove Yahweh's name from his own testimony and replace it with the title of the Lord. And it was his assessment that if they were willing to deceive me on something like this, deliberately and knowingly removing Yahweh's name from his own text and deliberately replacing it with this title, what else are they lying about? Why should I ever trust them? And that really goes right to the core of the issue, doesn't it? Why would you trust people that have deceived you in this way? Why would you trust anyone associated with the Roman Catholic Church? They did this. In fact, they've even banned the use of Yahweh's name. You can't say it in their churches. Why would you trust them? Why would you trust someone when they claim to have the keys to heaven, when the keys to heaven were clearly given to Dode? They claim to be in charge, Yah's vicars on earth, and that honor was given to Dode. Why would you trust him? What were you going to say, Jibby?
No, I was just saying that was the same thing the Pharisees did. They outright banned the use of Yahweh's name.
Yes. Yeah. The truth be known, there is nothing that we should enjoy more than celebrating Yahweh's name and his family. It may have been a dozen years ago, but I recall being frustrated knowing that Yod-Heh wasn't Yahweh. Because by God's own admission, it was based on Hayah. Well, how could it be Yahweh if it's based on Hayah, which is I will be. But no matter how long I searched, I couldn't find a single individual or a single resource that explained how to pronounce his name using evidence and reason. Laughably, those making an attempt resorted to Greek as if Hebrew was irrelevant. Even worse, the scholars and theologians were all in universal defiance of reality, claiming that Yahweh's name was unpronounceable because there were no vowels in Hebrew. If that is the case, then how is it that every other word and name is pronounceable using the same 22 letters, five of which are vowels? I cannot recall now if it was weeks or a month, but I remember examining the pronunciation of every Hebrew word in the entire lexicon contained a yod, a hey, or a waw. And while that led me to realize that it was either Yahuwah or Yahuwah, with 100% certainty, since there was no question regarding the pronunciation of the yod or the hey, the deciding factors concerning the waw were as apparent as they were plentiful. There were scores of Hebrew names based upon Yahweh's name, which are now translated or transliterated again to Yob, Yoel, Yonah, making the pronunciation of the only letter in question, the waw, obvious. But the clincher was the three most commonly spoken Hebrew words, Shalom,
okay.
Torah, and Elohim. They're all written with the waw creating the O sound. It's Shalom, S-H-L-W-A-M-E-M. Torah, the Teth, Wah, Rosh, Hey. Elohim is from Eloah, Eleph, Lamed, Wah, Hey. And all you have to do is just look at these words. They demonstrate that Yod Hey Wah is pronounced as Yahuwah. Easily pronounceable. And throughout the text, it was being pronounced. There is no one that can show great reverence for Yahweh's name by not pronouncing it, as these scholars claim. The next step was to accurately describe what his name means. And by turning to Paleo Hebrew, doing so was as straightforward as it was magnificent. In Yod Hey Wah Hey, we see Yahweh's hand reaching down and out to us. His hand is open. It's like a father reaching down and out to a child. It reveals that God is ready to welcome us and lift up those willing to grasp hold. And the two Heys, we find two individuals, a man and a woman, as it would transpire. Based upon their placement, a concluding hey makes a Hebrew noun feminine. Both individuals, which are likely representative of Abraham and Sarah and their role in the covenant, and Sarah's placement in the middle of Yisrael, it's Yisrael, are standing up, reaching up, and looking up to God. The wah is a tent peg, the device used to secure and enlarge a home, including the tent of the eternal witness. It speaks of increasing and adding to something, which is the case of the two individuals within God's name. It would indicate that they are being magnified and enriched by this covenant, by standing up, reaching up, looking up to God, and grasping hold of his outstretched hand. In Yahweh's name, therefore, we see the covenant family and its purpose. Now, sharing what I had discovered about the most important name in the universe, the source of life and enlightenment, of liberation and empowerment, became my passion. It remains my passion to this day. Yes, indeed, Dode would sing, you commend favor and bless. Those who are right and therefore innocent, Tzedak, Yahweh. With that which resembles a shield, which envelops and surrounds him, such that you can accept him and be pleased with him. Wow. It's affirmation of something we've determined a long, long time ago. That the way that Yahweh makes us appear perfect in his sight is he envelops us with a garment of light. He adorns us in a garment of light. Where there is light, there is no darkness. It's not like with Dode that he emphasized the brilliance and just overlooked the flaws. It's just that once he was immersed in the Spirit, there were no flaws. And where there is light, there is no darkness. Light is the opposite of darkness. darkness only exists where there is no light. Where there is light, there is no darkness. You know that what Yahweh said, the moment that he anointed Dod, made him Mashiach long before he was king, he said the Spirit came upon him at that moment and never left him. That is what made Dod especially perfect and vindicated in Yah's eyes. And so he knew that he was covered with a shield, this garment of light, which envelops and surrounds him, such that we are acceptable and pleasing before God. And that's how God demonstrates his favor. So call me slow. I finally figured it out after all these years. Well, I've recognized that Dod was considered Tzedak, vindicated and innocent in Yah's eyes, because he was Tzedak, correct and right about Yahweh. It wasn't until I wrote this chapter and made that translation that I came to apply the same standard to Yosha, who was, for most of his life, similar to the rest of us. He was born an ordinary man. He didn't become the diminished manifestation of Yahweh until the Spirit came upon him, just as the Spirit came upon Dod as he was anointed. Therefore, he could not have been perfect unless it was based upon this same Tzedak standard. The standard Yahweh established through Dod. Yosha was considered perfect because his understanding of Yahweh and his Torah was correct. And that is why his initial declaration on the Mount, where he extolled the virtues and enduring nature of the Torah and prophets, was so vital. He declared that it was all correct, right down to the smallest strokes of the smallest letters, and would continue to be right for as long as the heavens and earth exist. And that is what made him the perfect Zeruah, sacrificial lamb. But to our credit, we long ago came to realize that the method that Yahweh uses to perfect the imperfect is to envelop them in his Spirit of light, thereby adorning and crowning his covenant children, making us appear perfect in his eyes, because where there is light, there is no darkness. Light obliterates it, eliminating it. Well, that is now the conclusion of the fifth Mizmor. When we commence this time next week, what I would like to do is continue this chapter, since it is so revealing. Our next venture in this chapter is going to be into the 103rd Mizmor. I'm convinced that you'll find it as exciting and as interesting, as thought-provoking as I did not so long ago when we did the translations. So thank you, JB, for joining us. I know that you had a long drive today. And for all of you listening, thank you again.
Time of leaving and hitting traffic.
Yes, we know, I know it well. Well, thank you again. Happy Shabbat. Good night, everyone.
Good night.